Well, good.
All right, good evening. Welcome to tonight's meeting. My name is Paula Eight, Mayor of Kingborough. It's a pleasure to welcome all of you to this evening's meeting on Monday, the 2nd of February, 2026. Welcome to everyone who is in the public gallery. Could you please make sure your mobile phones are switched off or on silent? Time being 5:30pm, I now officially declare this meeting open. Council now operates under the Local Government Meeting Procedures Regulations of 2025, and under these I'm required to advise you that an audio or audio-visual recording is being made of the meeting. All persons attending the meeting are to be respectful of and considerate towards other persons attending the meeting, and language and conduct at the meeting that could be perceived as offensive, defamatory or threatening to a person attending the meeting or listening to the recording is not acceptable. The audio recording of council meetings is made publicly available on our website, and meetings are live streamed on YouTube. So we also welcome those people who are watching along at home online. And I'll now ask staff to confirm that the audio recording has started. Thank you. I wish to acknowledge the traditional custodians of this land, pay respects to elders past and present, and acknowledge today's Tasmanian Aboriginal community. Our attendees this evening are myself, Councillor Eight, the Deputy Mayor, Councillor Gladewright, Councillor Antoli, Councillor Bain, Councillor Cordova, Councillor Dean, Councillor Fox, Councillor Richardson and Councillor Street. From our staff this evening, we have the CEO, Mr Stewart, the Director of People and Finance, Mr Spinks, Director of Engineering Services, Mr Mackey, Director of Governance, Recreation and Property Services, Mr Smee, Director of Environment Development and Community Services, Ms Shakuti, our Lead Strategic Planner, Mr Stander, our Senior Statutory Planner, Mr Huang, our Communications Officer, Mr Heather, and our Executive Assistant, Mrs Morton. We have one apology this evening, and that is from Councillor Midgley. We're on page one, confirmation of minutes. I'm looking for a mover and a seconder that the minutes of the open session of Council Meeting Number 1, held on the 19th of January 2026, be confirmed as a true record. Got a mover in Councillor Fox and a seconder in the Deputy Mayor. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? Motion is carried. Turning now to page two, workshops held since the last council meeting. We held a workshop on the 27th of January in relation to the AFL High Performance Centre. Declarations of interest. Does anyone have an interest they would like to declare? The CEO.
Yes, I'd like to declare an interest in item 15.2 and I'll leave the room.
Thank you very much. Any further ones? Councillor Dean and then Councillor Cordova.
Thanks, Mayor. I just had an interest in 12.1, but I'll be staying in the room.
And Councillor Cordova?
Just to declare, I've had correspondence, as I'm sure a lot of us have, correspondence from representors relating to the development application at 16 Adelong Drive, but I'll be staying in the room.
We do. I think everyone has received those correspondence, so we won't need to individually declare those, but thank you very much. Any further declarations? No, we'll move on then. Transfer of agenda items. Is there any item on the agenda that a councillor would like to transfer from open into closed or closed into open session? No, thank you. Takes us already to questions without notice from the public. Does any member of the public wish to ask a question? If so, you know the drill, most of you. Please come forward. Good evening.
Hello. I'm Letitia Knight Woodbridge, property owner. I just want to, the last time we were in chambers, there was some mention about, I think it was to do with one of the motions that was put forward, and it was around the biodiversity offset, and I think we need some more clarity around that, because it came across that there were, I think it was 535 properties in total that had paid biodiversity offsets in a total of $1 million, which you received, which equals $2,000 on average per property. And if that was the real case, I don't think anyone would have much of a problem with that. So we just want to get some clarification around those numbers if we can. So the questions that I have is, over the past 5 years, how many properties within the municipality have entered into a Part 5 agreement in lieu of paying a biodiversity offset? And can council provide mapping or spatial data identifying the location of those Part 5 areas?
Ms Shakuti.
I'll have to take that on notice because I don't have that information readily at hand.
For all those properties that have entered into a Part 5 agreement over the past 5 years, what was the cumulative total value of the biodiversity offsets that were originally calculated or requested prior to the Part 5 agreement being accepted?
I suspect that the answer will be she will take that on notice, correct?
I will add to that in that generally paying a financial offset is the last tier of the hierarchy for offsetting. So it's not that an amount is calculated or a Part 5 agreement. So it's unlikely that we will have that information, but I will take it on notice to clarify.
And over the past 5 years, how many development applications remained undetermined or significantly delayed where the applicant has not agreed to either pay a biodiversity offset or voluntarily enter into a Part 5 agreement?
Ms. Shakuti.
I'll have to take that on notice.
Thank you. Any further questions on notice, please come forward.
Hi, Tamika Adkins, Oyster Cove. I also have some Part 5 agreement questions. So is the requirement to pay a biodiversity offset mandated by legislation or is it applied at the discretion of council officers?
Ms. Shakuti.
It is the head of power for that is under the Land Use Planning Approvals Act and the planning scheme. There is also provision for offsetting as to meet in the new incoming scheme as well, and then Kingborough Council's offset policy is how we consider those offsets when triggered by the scheme.
So what guidelines or thresholds are used to ensure consistency between those applicants?
Ms. Shakuti.
That is outlined in our offset policy, which is available on our website. I can say that that policy has undergone technical review and aligns with, and I apologise, I can't remember the name of the guidelines, but it's a Tasmanian or regional guidelines for offsetting, and it has also been reviewed by the state government as well.
That council set the figure, not necessarily the item, but the figure that an applicant would pay?
It is determined in the policy. I believe that was set by council, but in reference to standard or other values that other offset policies or guidelines within the state would set.
And just finally, so how does council ensure that two landowners clearing similar areas do not receive materially different offset requirements?
Ms. Shakuti.
By applying the guidelines in the policy and the if they are paying a financial offset, that is actually determined by the type of vegetation that they're clearing, so the type of tree, and community and the area, and then the ratios that are set out in the policy. So for an area on one property, the payment might be different to the area on another property because it's dependent on what is actually being cleared and the area of what is being cleared.
Thank you. Any further questions, please come forward. Good evening.
Hi, Nick Bush from Longley. In August 2021, Kingborough Council ceased having a tree bylaw provisions within their existing environmental bylaws. On July 2022, Council passed a resolution by absolute majority of its intention to make trees on a private property a bylaw. On October 2023, the draft was finally went out to public consultation. My question is, what was the response to the consultation and where is that information available?
Ms. Shakuti.
That's a good question. I believe it was made available. I'd have to take that on notice. The response, again, from my recollection, was that the majority, I can't remember the exact division, was for the bylaw. And I do believe it has been circulated, and I will have to find out where and how.
I believe that currently the bylaw is still in the process of needing final approval. My question is, what is the council's intentions with the bylaw and its relation to the proposed planning scheme?
Ms. Shikuchi. No, CEO.
I'll answer that question. So the bylaw was subject to a motion that was brought up through the AGM, and council staff are working on a response to come back to council to formally address that motion. So it will be subject of a further conversation around this table in the coming weeks.
In 2022, Councillor Gideon Gordover pushed the tree bylaw and used the response from a few hundred responses to get the unanimous vote from councillors as a sign of indication that the majority of ratepayers wanted the bylaw. My question is it normal for council to base a decision using the results from a small number of submissions, particularly from a targeted survey or audience, to justify decisions that may not represent the broader community's views, such as the rural community and those who are directly affected by these laws' application?
Ms. Shikuchi.
Thank you. My understanding of the engagement and consultation that was undertaken is that it was undertaken in a similar manner to how we undertake consultation for other policies and bylaws, etc. So yes, it will form part of the decision making, but it is then for the councillors in the chamber to make their decisions.
Well, without that previous information for the consultation, I can't really make a comment on that either. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions, please come forward.
Karen Groves, the Snug. As part of the draft LPS process, the Council Planning Authority completed a non-compulsory 40-page S35G statement. This was required to be based on feedback gained from community representations. Only four representations were cited, one of which was Council's own, and none of which asked for the planner's proposed extension of environmental controls. Not one recommendation to the TPC alluded to the wicked problem of applying the LCZ or RLZ to existing environmental or rural living zones. Creation of another zone, maybe, or bigger RLZ lot sizes, despite this being a consistent concern in representations. My question is to the councillors. How did councillors pass the S35G statement, 40 pages of recommendations based on four representations, and miss the chance to mention or suggest remedy for the zoning challenges mentioned in the remaining 616 representations?
Ms. Shikuchi.
Thank you. My understanding is that the Section 35G report addressed specifically some recommendations for the SPPs. The remaining content was a replication of a submission to the SPO regarding the review of the SPPs made I think about 2 or 3 years ago. In terms of endorsement, it came before that report was attached with the Section 35F report when submitting the draft LPS after exhibition.
And can I just add to that answer?
Yeah.
Because when we did consider as a planning authority those two documents jointly, we also did amend the motion that had been put forward to include a paragraph that would suggest that in providing all that information to the TPC, that a covering letter be prepared that outlined all of the concerns that had, that the broad themes of concerns that members of the community and representatives had put forward during the process. So that was an amendment put on the floor of the chamber to the recommendation, and we did do that in the subsequently to what was submitted.
Okay, so you're saying that the other 616 representations were acknowledged through one cover letter?
No.
Not in the 40-page other document.
No, but they were all included in the Section 35F as well.
Yes.
So, but what I'm saying is we also wanted to highlight the broad themes that we were receiving from the community as part of the process, because we wanted to make sure it was front and centre as sort of the first document that would be seen when that information went to the TPC.
Though they're both submitted the same day to councillors, is that, just to clarify, the 35F report and the 35G
yes,
statement were submitted.
We considered them at the same
together moment. The 2 days yes. before they were due to go to the TPC.
Ms. Shikuchi.
I suggest we take this on notice to ensure that we get a accurate response to you so that we can
sure.
review the timelines.
Exactly yeah. when they were considered, whether that was the same day or different.
My recollection was we had them at the on the same agenda, both the 35F and 35G, because I remember them being on there, but we'll double check
sure.
that.
Thank you. Just a little change. I'm just trying to understand how these things work. There are many benefits we're finding to supporting development in rural and regional areas, and ways we could also limit that sustainably or keep it sustainable. So, for example, if we move to rural living zones, some homeowners are going to still be limited by their lot size, their access, their services, their building requirements, overlays, cleared building envelopes, their money, time, effort. This would spread out new dwellings across regional areas of the municipality, and it provides individuals to care for a range then of environmental and natural features while reducing pressure on existing infrastructure, as opposed to developments that are in built-up areas that provide, for example, like large traffic volumes that would enter the Channel Highway at one place. These sorts of things are spread out. So it's arguably a credible and sustainable way to provide low-density dwellings. I'm interested in whether Kingborough Council will be supporting this kind of development by recommending allowances for rural development and building be extended in the next Strelis through feedback that is due this month.
To Mr. Adrian? Not you. Yep. The CEO.
Thank you.
Council hasn't determined what a submission on the Strelis will be yet, so that's still to be determined what Council's position is that we may put in a submission to the document under consideration at the moment.
And final question?
Yeah, last question is similar. You might need to check this one too. So are there other ways that Council could propose to support rural and regional development through recommendation to the Strelis? For example, not just housing supply, but service delivery, infrastructure, transport, access to employment, aged care services and education, and providing those in those places. For those that are outside, let's say, satellite or major cities and towns in Kingborough.
Oh, Mr. Stander.
But otherwise, what might you support those?
Mr. People? Stander.
I have to get used to the fact that I don't have to stay through the chair.
No, you don't.
Yeah. thank you for that question. Look, and I'll most probably touch on your previous question as well. I think there's different ways to approach planning and strategic planning. The Southern Tasmania Regional Strategy has got, I guess, an approach to allow a lot of densification to happen around the major centres, but it also allows for rural development to occur and densification in those areas. If you listened in on some of the LPS hearings, Council did actually propose densification in some of the rural living areas, which the Commission is still considering. One of the things that was brought up in the discussions is that Council need to undertake some strategic work, basically to look at areas where we can promote some of that growth and so some of those areas. Some areas do have challenges, so we recognise that. So I guess the simple answer is there's the ability to do that through regional planning, but also at local planning. The only challenge is our local planning can't go against the regional planning. So that when I speak to people on a daily basis, I advocate for people to make a submission on the review of the Southern Tasmania Regional Land Use Strategy that's out for exhibition at the moment, because that is the ground and the underlying work that will inform everything else that we do. So it's extremely important for people to get their heads around that and to make a submission.
Thank you. And just clarifying, they've got to the 22nd of February to do that. Is that right?
I have to double check that, but yes, it's later this month.
20 days to get your head around that document.
Yep.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Right, we'll move on then. We are now at questions on notice from the public, still on page two. We had a number of questions. The first from Mr. Dennellan in relation to Algona Road shared path and streetlights and power, with a response from Mr. Mackey. A question in relation to an outcome of a 2023 AGM motion. The question was from Ms. Adkins, with a response from Ms. Shakuti. Question in relation to motions moved at AGMs from Mr. Biggins, with a response from Ms. Shakuti. Question in relation from Mr. Hodson in relation to zoning, sewer water park and road reserves, with a response from Ms. Shakuti and Mr. Langman. Question from Mr. Redeker, with a response from Ms. Shakuti in relation to percentage of community for and against LCZ. Question from Ms. Rogers, with a response from Ms. Shakuti in relation to bushfire mitigation. And finally, a question on wildlife from Ms. Winter, with a response from Ms. Quinn. Takes us to page nine, questions without notice and councillors. Do any councillors have a question? Councillor Fox, then Councillor Cordova, and then Councillor Richardson.
Thank you, Mayor. My question relates to the RIP on Blacktons Bay. Could a report be prepared by council staff for council to consider placing signage at the northern end of Blacktons Bay Beach to alert the public of the presence of a dangerous RIP in this area?
Thank you. The Deputy Mayor and myself have already spoken to the CEO about this this afternoon, and following the events on the weekend, where there were a number of young people that thankfully were rescued by some very heroic members of the community or young people themselves. We are certainly going to look at that question of signage. The CEO and I recently, or some months ago, met with Surf Life Saving Australia to discuss a proposal that they have to install signage with their signs about water safety, but also they have a device attached to them, which is a personal flotation device that can be used if a member of the community is undertaking a rescue. And so the discussion that we had was that they're proposing to roll those out in a number of beaches around the state, but particularly to our non-patrolled beaches like Blacktons Bay. So we're working through that process with them, because obviously we want everybody to be safe, but if you have too much signage, it can get very cluttered. So the proposal is that potentially the information on the RIP would be included with that information with the rescue devices. So I've asked for that work to be sped up in light of what's occurred. Further question?
Could I add, could the matter be dealt with urgently? I have lived in Blacktons Bay since I was 1 year old. People have drowned in that area. And I feel it's urgent that the sign goes up now, rather than wait for equipment to go in. There is already a sign saying dangerous area, but it's relating more to the rocks. But the word RIP needs to be put up, perhaps on that sign immediately, because I think they're going. The trouble is, children go and play in the sheltered area because there's a nice picnic area of a shelter. The parents aren't aware of what's the dangers are that the water looks calm and it looks safe, but the reason it's calm is because there is a rip, and close to there are big waves, so the children avoid the big waves. So it's an accident waiting to happen, yeah. And it'll happen again within a few weeks.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'll just ask the CEO if he'd like to add anything to that.
Not a lot further context to what you've already said, Mayor, but we will absolutely look at this in a prompt manner.
Thank you. Next I have Councillor Cordova and then Councillor Richardson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mayor. Two questions. The first one relates to illegal vegetation removals. I'm interested to get a bit of information around how many cases of illegal vegetation removal in Kingborough have been reported of late. And how many of those cases have been resolved? More broadly, are there any discernible trends? For example, are reports of illegal vegetation removals increasing or decreasing over time?
Ms. Shakuti.
Thank you. I don't have that information on hand. We certainly do have community members report potential unauthorised clearing, and other ways that we may become aware is when it has occurred on a property and then a new application comes in for that property and shows the clearing that we don't have the records for as well. So I'll take that on notice to give accurate information.
Councillor Cordova.
Thank you. Second question relates to dark sky reserve status, or I guess stargazing tourism. Some people may have noticed that on the 28th of January in the Mercury, it was reported that the Southern Midlands Council might be seeking to obtain dark sky reserve status to encourage stargazing tourism. And Australia has several officially designated sites for that. My question is, so South Bruny Island has remote beaches with many secluded spots to enjoy the incredible night sky. Has the council, and also the Local Government Association of Tasmania, recently endorsed a resolution to lobby the state government to establish statewide dark sky planning guidelines, and the tourism body Destination Southern Tasmania is pursuing the highest level of dark sky certification for the TWA, the Wilderness World Heritage Area. My question, as it relates to Bruny Island, is has the Kingborough Council looked into obtaining dark sky certification, or dark sky reserve status, to encourage that kind of tourism to Bruny?
Ms. Shakuti.
To my knowledge, not recently. I believe it was looked at some time ago. It is not something we're actively reviewing or pursuing at the moment. If we were to, it would have to be in consideration with our other environmental management priorities we have.
Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. Just a quick follow-up to that relating to Kingborough Council's engagement in the tourism space. So obviously I'm mentioning specifically astrotourism here, but more broadly, is the council engaged in promoting tourism? Like, I remember that previously we used to actually fund tourism promotions and things like that, to the tune of, I think, maybe $20,000 or something like that. Is that budgeted for any more, or is that on Kingborough Council's horizon to support tourism more directly than, well, like, financially?
Ms. Shakuti.
I believe it's still being funded. Is it to Tourism South?
No, CEO.
Sorry, thank so you.
Council financially contributes to Destination Southern Tasmania. Beyond that, I'm not aware of any separate light items that we have to fund the tourism ventures.
Next I have Councillor Richardson.
Thank you, Mayor. So my question relates to a country road in, or a rural road, I guess, in Stud. The Sprouse Road, which is a rather steep dirt road, steep and narrow. There's been a couple of development applications been approved for up that road recently, increasing the road traffic from four properties to six, which, you know, small numbers, but significant increase. So the question was around what requirements do we have for the construction phase of on a narrow road? And the second question is, are there any plans in place to upgrade, widen and generally fix up Sprowls Road?
Mr. Mackey.
I can take the second part of that question. I think given it's a minor rural road with only a small amount of dwellings, I think it's very unlikely that it would warrant any upgrade. They will take it on notice and give a more fulsome response. In terms of controls, not to my knowledge, is there any requirement for controls on the road during the construction phase?
Thank you. Further questions? Councillor Antoli.
Thanks, Mayor. I have two questions. The first is regarding cat management. A resident has been contacting me on behalf of a range of residents who live around the Algona Reserve, particularly properties that border the reserve in Sonnet Drive, and it has to do with ongoing allegations of roaming domestic cats into the reserve and the neighbouring yards. They are perceiving an impact on the bird life. They've talked about a noticeable reduction in certain bird species over the past few months. They approached council and allegedly received advice that the staff member who previously was responsible for setting cat traps has retired, and no staff member has been identified to replace that person, which they felt was, in their view, not good enough. And they're concerned that the current resourcing limits council's ability to respond through trapping or enforcement. The residents have suggested some potential responses. I'm not sure all of which are very manageable. Letterbox drop reminding cat owners of their responsibilities. We have an issue with that with our particular street in Dayspring Drive in Margate, with cat owners who are letting their cats roam around, and that killed one of my daughter's guinea pigs, which brought grief into the Antoli family. So they want to know whether trapping programs are active, paused or under review, and what is our broad policy position on cats near reserves. So I'm wondering if council could sort of address this general issue with the community.
Cat management is my favourite topic, as you know, but I'll ask Ms. Shakuti.
They've approached you, Mayor, not me. I don't even like
and
cats.
And I'm sorry for your daughter's guinea pig loss. That's not nice. Ms. Shakuti.
Thank you. So, yes, at the moment we don't have a resource fulfilling that that task of cat trapping. It will resume when we allocate a resource, and that is in train at the moment. At times, as people will know who work in organisations, recruitment and et cetera can take a little bit of time, so that we're looking at that. We do undertake a lot of education activities, and we have done some targeted education, particularly around Algona, but in the broader area as well. Unfortunately, so we have authority to implement the CAP Management Act, so if we are aware of breaches, we will act on those. We work with the Department of Natural Resources when there is instances of cat hoarding and multiple cat permits, etc. In terms of policy position, we have Bruning Island is where cats are not permitted or have to be contained. Huntingfield is similar in terms of you can own a cat, but it has to be suitably contained. I suppose outside of those areas, we don't have a policy position. Of course, we encourage responsible cat ownership, though, and are continuously active in educating and working with community members about that.
Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Mayor. Appreciate the update. This particular resident, who seems to be representing others, has made mention that a lot of correspondence that he has sent to council hasn't been answered. which conflicts with the fact that he's told me he's had some answers. Would it be possible for me to send the package of emails to a responsible officer for some sort of response to him and to them to make sure that they feel heard? To yourself? Okay, yes. Thank you.
Absolutely. And can I just reiterate Ms. Shakuti's comments in relation to responsible cat management? Because it's estimated, when we've done tracking studies in the past, it's estimated that the cats, both domestic cats and feral cats in Kingborough, kill collectively around 600,000 native wildlife every year, if you extrapolate the figure out. So that is a significant amount, and that's everything from a tiny little skink through to, you know, larger animals, birds and guinea pigs and rabbits and so on. And so, unfortunately, when the state government reviewed the Cat Management Act several years ago, despite the fact that cat management facilities such as 10 Lives recommended that cats should be contained, the state government decided not to take up that recommendation. But as we know from Bruny Island, where the cats do have to be contained, that can make a significant difference to decreasing the wildlife that is being killed as a result of cats roaming. So it's not just feral cats. I think there's a lot of people think that they're beautiful little tabby or ragdoll is never going to harm anything because it just doesn't have it in their nature. Unfortunately, all cats have predatory nature, and if they get out, then they will attack something if they see it, no matter how domesticated they are. So we certainly do encourage, and I know when I have students, the Deputy Mayor and I quite often have schools come through the council, and we do mock council meetings with them, and one of the things that we talk about is responsible cat management. And at first, when I say to them, do you think your cats should be kept inside, all the students say, oh no, it's cruel, they need to be let outside. And when you start to educate them about, you know, why should they stay inside, it's for their own safety as well, so they don't get run over or stolen. In the past before I used to contain my cats, I've had cats both run over and I've had cats that have been stolen by other people. So we really do want to get that message out very clearly to people that it's not mandatory in most areas, but we do encourage people to keep their cats inside safe, and they can adapt to being fully inside, and there are lots of things that people can do to modify parts of their homes to allow them to still have cat runs and a whole range of things. So, yeah, I'll stop talking about cats now. Councillor Antoli, another question. Yeah,
thank you. Thank you for the thorough response. I have a totally different question. This is regarding the Sherwood Park car park. Now, I have been corresponding with council officers on that, and I'm very grateful for the responses. There has been an ongoing issue where the people who live opposite Sherwood Park car park, people opposite are having their ongoing issues with the unsealed car park, fouling their front yards with dust, entering their roof guttering and their rainwater collection systems. I had some meetings today with some people there. They've talked about hooning activity in the car park, people doing donuts. One individual with his two young sons who lives around the corner, and they passed that on to police. They've identified antisocial behaviour, including a suspicion of drug use and drug sales, and the residents are afraid to report this to police with evidence because it requires them getting too close to the offenders, because you probably will know that there's a bit of a mound there at the car park before it cascades down into Roslyn Avenue. So they want to know what our policy would be about possibly putting up some freestanding CCTV cameras attached to the building or nearby to provide evidence of the misdemeanours to police when they do happen. I'm wondering what council's position on that, noting that we have some substantial work there slated for the ongoing forward estimates.
Yeah, a couple of years down the track for that work, unfortunately, though, but the existing change rooms are still there. Who would like to speak to this? Mr. Smee.
Sealing of the Sherbet Oval car park is a project that has been identified as being desirable, and indeed we had that project costed in 2021, and back then the cost was, from our engineering department, was $660,000. So it probably is more of an aspirational project, given the other priorities for the oval. In recent years we've upgraded the lighting, the drainage, irrigation. The pitch is underway, and as councils will be aware, the change rooms is our latest project. So the sealing of the car park is desirable, but it is, in terms of the cost benefit, it's probably lower than some of the other projects we've had to address. CCTV, we would take advice from TAS Police in relation to whether that is something that would be of benefit in that area. We generally don't put up CCTV cameras without instruction from the police as to whether that is a location that A, needs to be able to feed back to the police station so it's monitored, and B, whether they consider the level of antisocial behaviour to warrant it.
Councillor Ntoli.
Thank you. So even with the recent vandalism of some young people setting fire to part of the frontage of the building some weeks back, something like that might not even trigger council wanting to look after its assets with maybe some CCTV footage? Do we really need to rely on the police to tell us when we can put cameras up?
It's just me.
Given that the feed and monitoring goes to the police, it's not something we would do in isolation to them.
Councillor Ntoli.
Thank you. So could you clarify what you mean by the feed and the monitoring? So cameras that record information, and if there's an incident, you can just go back to see it. Does it need to be as full-blown a solution as what you're mentioning, or do you have something else in mind?
Mr. Smee.
There are issues around the retrieval of the data that's stored on the by those cameras, and the position of the police is that their very strong preference is to have a feedback to the police station rather than these individual data recorders that you then have to go and view the tape.
Councillor Ntoli.
Thank you. So they're wanting access to more centralised solution. Is that what, okay? That's their preferred method. Okay.
And so you may be aware, Councillor Ntoli, that the majority of our cameras, and I can't remember the figure, I think it's around 60 or 70 cameras that we have CCTVs throughout the municipality at the moment. And we've done significant work over the last 2 years of bringing a lot of those back onto line. They were outdated, needed to be upgraded. They've been brought back onto line, and all of those cameras now feed directly into the police station, so in the event of an incident they can go and view it straight away, or if somebody loses something or reports an incident at, say, Kingston Park, the police can view that. Previously, some of the devices that we had around the place, information was just stored on like a hard drive, and in the event of something happening and them needing to access it, it was a bit more problematic. So a number of years ago now, we went through a bit of an MOU with police about how, you know, the cameras would be, I guess, maintained by us in a working order, but also making sure that they were letting us know if there were issues with them, because we don't see if they're down because the feed is across the road there at the police station.
Thank you very much for the answers.
Thank you. Any further questions? No, I'll keep going. That takes us to page 9, questions on notice from councillors. There were no questions on notice. Open session of council now adjourns at 6:13 p.m. and that means that the planning authority commences at 6:13 p.m. We're on page 10. We've got PSA 2025-1, proposed amendment to the Kingborough Interim Planning Scheme 2015. site-specific qualification, additional discretionary uses and DA 2025-164, development application for a medical centre at 124 Channel Highway, Taroona, with a recommendation on page 21. And I'm looking for a mover and a seconder, please. I've got a mover in the Deputy Mayor and a seconder in Councillor Cordova. The Deputy Mayor.
Thank you. So the purpose of this report is to consider the representations in regards to the proposed amendment to the scheme, allowing for the new medical centre. I note that we're not the final decision makers on this. This is being sent off to the TPC and there will be hearings regarding this one. There are seven representations in total. The main things that were raised were impacts on amenity and the suitability of a non-residential use in a low-density residential area. I just wonder strategically, though, if this is a good outcome for this community. I noticed that this property is currently for sale, and it is for sale as an approved medical centre, which is a little bit cheeky because it's not yet approved. But it just makes me wonder, the proponent then hasn't... Can you talk me through what happens if they can't secure doctors and then this has gone through and it is now a medical centre? What happens then?
Mr. Stander?
Yes. Thank you. Good question. I had a phone call this afternoon from somebody in the community that's asked the same question. Look, I think if the applicant walks away from this proposal, somebody owns the land, so the site-specific qualification that council is supporting and that will ultimately be decided by the commission will stay with the land. So if the land gets sold to somebody else, they have a variety of options available under that site-specific qualification, but also under the new Tasmanian planning scheme. One of the questions that I got this afternoon, so I'm going to be cheeky and add to that, was a lot of people ask me, so if it's not for medical centre, what's the pathway for a landowner or a new owner of that site to go through to get something else on the site, like food services and so forth? It will be a separate application that would be subject to notification. People will have the opportunity to provide input on that. Things like noise and traffic issues are things that would be considered as part of that development. So it would be specific for that development. If this approval goes through, in a nutshell, and it's approved as medical centre, whoever owns the land and they get a tenant will have to operate it in accordance with the permit.
Deputy Mayor.
Well, I guess we handball this over to the TPC and the representatives can make their case and we'll see what happens.
Any further discussion? Councillor Dean.
Thank you, Mayor. I have some questions. When this initially went through back in December, can I just clarify, was this the original planned proposal for it to be held at a hearing?
Mr. Stander.
All planning scheme amendments go through a process where council first initiate it. It goes on public exhibition. The community gets opportunity to provide comment. Then it comes back to council and, yes, then the commission makes the final decision. So there's always opportunity with planning scheme amendments where it's combined with the planning permit to modify some of the permit conditions. And that's a good place for those hearings to nut it out, to understand the issues further and then to modify the permit. It's been done in the past, so it's not unusual.
And just on page 11 of the agenda, there is quite a useful flowchart which shows the planning scheme amendment process, the five steps and where we're up to at the moment, which is step three, which is the report on the representations ahead of the public hearings and then the TPC's decision. Councillor Dean.
Yeah, and just to follow up on that, I just wanted to make sure that was clear, that we aren't changing or veering from what was originally planned. And just a follow-up question. When, in 2024, we approved a DA for what essentially was a renovation of the site, an upgrade to the deck, the car park, etc., there was a specific condition in that relating to the use of the deck in that it must be used for access to and from the facility and not to be used as social gatherings, etc. Now, the Deputy Mayor has referred to the advertisement by the estate agent for the site. Now, I do note that they actually have pointed out that this is currently going through a planning amendment process. They haven't said necessarily that this has been approved. But the one thing that I take issue with is that they have outlined that there is a generous deck that can be used for a versatile range of uses. And given that we had put in a permit, a condition in the permit back in 2024, my question relates to that because I know that that was originally agreed to by the applicant because it was raised by residents in terms of use. So I just want to ask whether that is going to be still applicable, and if not, whether it can be something that can be considered or that we can make sure that is at least considered by the TPC during that hearing.
Mr. Stander.
Thank you for that question. Yes, and one of the representatives actually picked up on that issue as well. The permit that council issued before was in relation to a different use. This is a new use. They didn't specify that they want to use this deck area for anything other than associated with the medical centre. Given that it is such a significant structure and the fact that we've got representations around that deck area, you will note in my report and recommendation of highlighted that it is a matter that I would like to discuss with the representer and the applicant to see if there's a way that we could address that through the conditions. But because there's a bit of uncertainty and also given the fact that the land is up for sale, it is quite challenging. So I think the best approach is sit around the table and work out what that area will be utilised. It's been assessed through council's previous report as just an addition to the medical centre, nothing other than that. I guess it also goes back to the comment that I made earlier. If in future they want to change that and change it into a food services restaurant and so forth, then it will take on a totally different dynamic, and that is something that will need to be tested through the planning scheme but also with the adjoining neighbours.
Councillor Dean.
Yeah, thank you to the council staff for just clarifying that last point that was just made. I think I would hope provide some reassurance to the community that this will need to come before us again if there is a change of use, and given that this isn't the final decision, that it will be before TPC with a holistic discussion between applicant and representors, noting as well that the applicant themselves in their submission aren't quite happy, but I understand that in the interest of compromise that I think the recommendation is sensible, and I'm happy to support as it reads now. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you, Councillor Dean. Any further discussion? No? Deputy Mayor, did you want to sum up? No, I will put the recommendation then, moved by the Deputy Mayor and seconded by Councillor Cordova. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? The motion is carried unanimously. Takes us to page 22, item 12.2, development application for 8 multiple dwellings, one existing at 16 Adelon Drive, Kingston, with a recommendation on page 36. I'm looking for a mover and a seconder, please. Moved Councillor Cordova, seconded Deputy Mayor. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. So there's been a good deal of community interest in this, and we've received multiple representations, 7 representations in opposition to this development application for 8 multiple dwellings at 16 Adelong Drive, Kingston. The report itself addresses the issues raised by the representors, but there is no doubt that this is an intensification of use at that site. And so before I produce my contribution, I just wanted to ask some questions, firstly relating to the various representations, which had a lot of merit, particularly around their concerns relating to site distances and the idea of having 8 units and having vehicles pulling out into the street. So I just wanted to... I mean, one of the representatives raised with me the allegation that the traffic impact assessment is out of date or otherwise not fit for purpose. So please can we have it talked through to us or just unpack the site distance issues and why it is that it's the assessment of the planning officers that the road network can accommodate these additional trips.
Ms. Silver. Thanks for your questions. So we did have the TIA prepared
to support the application. Sorry, the applicant prepared the TIA for that application. So originally there were six dwellings approved for the same site, and this traffic impact assessment was updated to form the current addendum of the planning application. That assessment has been reviewed by a development engineer, and they were satisfied that the traffic impact assessment was correct and that there is sufficient site distances along the road. Given that the road speed is 50 kilometres an hour, the minimum site distance required is 45 metres or 69 metres, and they can achieve 70 metres to the left and 90 metres to the right along the road, so therefore it can meet the performance criteria.
Councillor Cordova.
Thank you. Through you, Mayor, the next question relates to the idea of moving the garbage bins to the other side and waste collection practicality in general. That was something that came up a lot. I just want to please explain to me, I guess, whether or not those concerns raised by the residents will be able to be enforced. Yeah, basically, please provide some assurance or otherwise that the issues around the waste, the garbage collection, will actually, that it won't be a massive problem for residential amenity in that neighbourhood.
Ms Silver.
So what we understand from the planning application is that each unit will have their own individual waste storage area, which meets the requirements of the scheme, except for one unit which didn't have the screen, which has the screen, but it was between the dwelling and the driveway. They're otherwise compliant, and then on waste collection days, which will be via a private contractor, they will move the bins to the side of the driveway at the top there to make it easier for collection, but that's just a temporary area for the bins, and then they will be moved back to the residence area where they would be more permanently left. Yeah, so the waste will be collected from what we're as part of the application twice per week.
Councillor Cordova.
So am I right in thinking, and this is potentially a question more for council enforcement, is that if the proponent doesn't comply with that permit condition or expectation, that they will therefore be in breach of their permit, so that they have to actually do what's just been explained. They actually have to do it, and if they don't do it, then they're in trouble.
Ms Silver.
Sorry, under the planning scheme, you have to provide a waste bin storage area, which they comply with. We don't have any mechanisms under the planning scheme for the bins to be taken back. That would be more an on-site body corporate management. So there'd be no way to condition the bins at the top to go back to their main area beside each dwelling.
Councillor Cordova.
So I think, as I mentioned earlier, there's a number of the representations contain totally reasonable, understandable, and I think concerns that have a good deal of merit, especially where they focus on traffic safety and parking spillover and waste servicing, as we've just been talking about. And of course, I'm very sympathetic to... Well, it's quite obvious that when you have an intensification of use, it's quite obvious that there will be privacy and amenity impacts of that. This is, I think, this proposal is single storey, so that has a reduced streetscape impact due to the internal lot configuration. I think that is something that is in its favour as well. The privacy impacts are real. I think the intensification of use of the road is real, and it's addressed in the report, but I wanted to make a higher level point here about what our responsibility is when we do see a proposal that complies with the scheme, and when we do see a proposal where the performance criteria have been met. I wanted to make it very clear that where the representations mention things like the impact on property values and things like that, that really isn't an assessable quality. And so where the representations didn't speak to the planning scheme itself, I obviously have to discount those in my deliberations because they're not planning tests. You know, if you say, well, this will impact my property value, well, that's actually just not a test that we are able to consider as a planning authority. They sit outside the planning framework. Broadly, the intensification of use at this site is appropriate because it does align with the zoning. This area is close to schools and shops and medical. It is an area that in the Southern Tasmanian Regional Land Use Strategy, we talk about these areas as requiring higher density. If it is a choice between strategic planning or causing the demand for housing to spread further out into greenfields developments that then gobble up more arable land or gobble up more area that is important for habitat and conservation preservation, then obviously it's, to me, although I'm hugely sympathetic to the neighbours who are going to be affected by this development, the reality is that good planning requires intensification of use in these areas that have a good deal of infrastructure, and it requires higher density in areas close to our central business district. So I am hugely sympathetic to the neighbours, and I know that there will be 7 households that will be upset by the decision that I'm making to support this application, but there will also, on the other side of that, be 8 or more people who will move into this area through that intensification, and it is for those people and those people who are trying to find a place to live in Kingborough that I am willing to support this intensification of use. So I don't want to discount or discredit in any way the very real impact on the lived experience of the people who are the neighbours of this development. But the reality is that intensification of use and higher density in this area is not only appropriate within the planning scheme, but I think it is also to be encouraged. So that's why I'll be supporting it. Thanks.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Further discussions, questions? Councillor Bain.
Thank you, Mayor. Just have a few follow-up questions which have come from some of the neighbouring residents. The first one's to do with the residential density for multiple dwellings. The acceptable solution is the 325 metres, whereas these ones in the application before us are well below that, in the 270s, I think. And the comment that was made from a lot of the neighbours is if you look along Adelong Drive, you don't see any properties which are sort of this density. So when it comes to the performance criteria, I guess the question is, how far beyond that do we look to make it an acceptable solution?
Ms. Silver.
There's no written distance, but the general consensus is it'd be around 100 metres from the site is what we normally look at from a planning perspective. So while the character along Adelong is the general residential and the larger lots, the site directly adjoining with the aged care and the 2 units, so I'm not sure of the road close by within 100 metres have that higher density, so it's difficult to argue that the proposal is not in character with the area because of those 2 sites and therefore can meet the performance criteria.
Councillor Vang.
Thank you. And just following up with one of Councillor Cordova's points, the vehicle movement was a big issue for a lot of the residents who believe that there is already some issues on the corner there with sight lines and trying to get out of the driveway safely and the buses that go to and fro. So we've heard that the traffic assessment has cleared all that. So if that was to continue to be an issue, is that something for the residents to raise outside of this planning application, I guess is my question.
Ms. Silver.
So we've discussed this internally. While there's no scope under the existing planning application, there may be other scopes through a council mechanism, which would need to be discussed further.
Councillor Bain. Oh, sorry, Ms. Shakuti.
I can add to that. If residents or community members felt that after the development is complete still had the same concerns, it could be sent through to council and could be reviewed by our road engineers if that was still to be an ongoing concern. However, noting that the traffic impact assessment doesn't assess it, that it will be.
Councillor Bain.
Thank you, Mayor. Just two final questions. There's quite a few trees to be removed along one of the fence lines, and just double checking the assessments have been done and none of those trees are significant or protected.
Mr. Huang.
Thank you, Mayor. I can confirm no notable trees with high conservation value will be removed. Thank you.
Councillor Bain.
Thank you. And just finally, the report mentions a previous easement which went down the side of one of the fences. I think it was transferred to the developer some time ago. Just confirming there is no infrastructure that sits underneath those easements currently.
Mr. Huang.
I can confirm the previous easements has been already removed, and I actually just before the meeting I also just downloaded the latest folio plan. It also shows it has been already removed directly. Thank you.
Councillor Bain.
No, that's all my questions. Thank you, Mayor.
Councillor Antolli.
Thank you, Mayor. I'd like to thank the council staff. They've done a great job, I think, of responding to the very legitimate concerns. And while we didn't see a fundamental redesign or refusal to trigger, there have been some issues that have been taken into account that have resulted in a translation of conditions or clarifications, the waste management issue. So, you know, condition that we has imposed for private collection, very important. The landscaping and boundary treatment, well, some provision has been made around some sensitive interfaces there, so that's well done. So can I ask, when an individual, forgive my ignorance, when an individual writes in, does their representation receive a tailored response, or is it done through the report itself because we've put into the report their concerns in groups?
Who would like to answer that? Ms. Silver?
So we look at each individual representation. We don't respond to each individual person, so we'd consolidate the issues and provide a response into the report. Sometimes if something needs to be teased out a bit further, we will contact the representor to understand their concerns and to refine the report response. But it's basically a general response to the concerns that are raised, because they're often the same, like very similar in terms of amenity or noise or privacy.
So they're grouped within the report according to the
grouped
themes.
Yeah.
And just to add to that, of course, we all, as councillors, we all have access to each of the individual representations that are made through the shared drive that we're able to access those files. So just so that I know that many members of the community who will be respondents to DAs, representatives to DAs, they will email us also in addition, but I think it's important for the community to know that we get every application and we're able to read those at our leisure. Councillor Antolli.
Thank you. Nothing to do with the planning team, more in terms of how do we best handle this. Is that normal for a representative not to receive some sort of a response apart from a cursory acknowledgement?
Ms. Chakuti.
Yes, it is normal. And as Ms. Silver stated, if we do need to reach out, we will, and sometimes we'll go visit the property of the representor too, particularly if we need to view the issue that they're talking about as well.
Councillor Antolli.
Is that a council norm or an industry-wide norm?
Ms. Silver.
I can confirm that's an industry-wide norm.
I appreciate that very
much. Councillor Antolli.
Thank you. I have one other question, if I can just have a look. So there was also concerns about the impact of a high-density development with the local community, but we understand from your report that it's really going to be, and they're small, these are small dwellings, so we're talking about maybe singles, maybe just a couple, older people, downsizes, that sort of a thing. So I'm assuming we're not really talking about families of six with children running around, that sort of a thing. So we've made that very clear, and I think you've sort of helped allay that fear in the report. And I just wanted to pass on, I thought you did a good job of answering the representations. As a councillor, I tend to go straight to, after reading the cursory information in the front, I go straight to the representations, because that's where the gossip is. That's where you find, because our best researchers are the people, not always, but are the people in the local community, and they tell you stuff that is just amazing. And I always like to make sure that there's been a robust response. I suppose what's sad is that the representors can't get educated on the journey with us and get their own response, but if that's an industry norm, that's certainly not a planet I feel like lifting on my own. So appreciate that. I'll be voting in favour.
Any further discussion? Councillor Street.
Thank you, Mayor. Like others, just want to recognise the number of representations that we've received, and certainly I've received a number of emails and recognise that a lot of those people are in the back of the room here tonight, and thank them for attending. By and large, I agree with the things that have already been said in relation to this application. I understand that people are going to be upset, and reasonably so, with the seeming decision of council in relation to this matter, but the application does fit within the terms of the planning scheme. With one potential exception that I just want some clarification around, just in relation to the multiple dwelling site areas in 10.4.1. Clearly, the proposal is for residential density that's less than that contained in the majority of multiple dwelling sites in the area, with the one exception being 26A Frasier Court. I'm just wondering whether our planning officers have any comment on the appropriateness of including 26A Frasier Court when it's a retirement living facility. And I suppose the question that I have around that is how appropriate that is to include it for residential density purposes when a retirement village is, in many cases, has things like shared common areas and higher density areas with larger surrounding common areas, which certainly seems to be, just anecdotally and looking at the aerial photography, that seems to be the case on 26A Frasier Court. So how appropriate is that as a guide to surrounding residential density?
Ms. Silver.
So with the planning performance criteria, it doesn't specify even that it needs to be residential. It focuses on the capacity of infrastructure and the site coverage, I guess, of existing development on established properties in the area, which is why we've included the aged care facility in the density analysis, and not just the other residential units. There are definitely provisions, like the aged care is still a residential use, and there are residential design requirements under the planning scheme for that as well. And I do acknowledge they are different, but as the scheme doesn't differentiate, there aren't any grounds to that needs to be considered from our interpretation as part of the analysis that we do.
Councillor
Street.
Sorry, Mayor.
Yeah.
Compatibility with density of existing developments is a pretty blunt instrument, is what you're saying.
Yeah, that's right.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I can tell you what the differences are between an aged care facility, which would technically be a non-residential use. Well, I mean, residential use, but it's not a non-dwelling use in the under the general residential zone. Sorry, I just had to think, was that inner residential? I'm getting mixed up. The general residential zone. So all the design requirements are generally the same in terms of building envelope. I can bring it up, sorry. Just bear with me for a second. I can't quite remember off the top of my head. Generally, it's a non-dwelling residential use in the zone, and I don't remember if it has private open space requirements, but I'll just... Yeah, I think it's more like the built form is the same in terms of setbacks and privacy. No differentiation. So non-dwelling, so it's still got the building envelope, 10.4.3. So the density is considered, so that needs to be the same scale as a residential development for dwellings. The site coverage and private open space are also considered as part of any application. 10.4.7, which is the front fences, waste storage. So it's very similar in that respect.
Councillor Stroke.
So thank you for the answer to the question. I suppose I recognise what's being said here, in that really we're stuck with the scheme as it is and the assessment as it is, which is a pretty blunt instrument. The concern that I've got from, and there's nothing that we can do about this that needs to be understood, is that with the scheme being the way that it is, you can end up assessing an aged care or retirement village application which has a very high density, and being satisfied that that fits within the surrounding area because of all of the things that come with retirement living or aged care, being large common areas and large areas of open space, and then having that thrown back at you on a subsequent application in the nearby area for a high density residential application, and being pointed back to the decision that you'd made previously and there not really being anything that you can do about that because you're being asked to assess density generally rather than density in context, I suppose, is the best way of putting that. But we are stuck with the scheme as it is. And I'm satisfied that the application meets the terms of the scheme as it is. For the people that are disappointed with that fact, I can only apologise.
Thank you, Councillor Street. Any further discussion? Just a question that I had that I know has been answered in the report, but just thought it might require some clarification. There was some suggestion by some representatives that we'd advertised this deliberately during the Christmas break when people were on holidays and unavailable. Could you just confirm that we have a statutory requirement in order to meet the timeframes that we're required and what that is, Ms. Silver?
So we do have a statutory requirement to extend the advertising period. So I think it was another 7 days or so that was added on to the normal 14 days. Is that correct? Was it 7 days?
Just given the notification period will be during the Christmas leave, and we also requested the relevant extensions, and the applicant already grant us relevant extensions to the just due to council's meeting as well as the Christmas leave.
Yeah. Thank you. I didn't want anybody in the community thinking that we had deliberately timed this at a time when people perhaps were focused on other things, but we do have a process that we need to adhere to, and we've
extended that time frame with the granting of the with the permission of the developer, so that it was coming to a meeting now. Look, I understand, and I thank everyone who's made representations in relation to this. I'm very familiar with the area. I used to live quite close to it, and this used to be my regular route that I would travel, and I still do occasionally on the bus. I do have some concerns about what impact there may be in future in relation to traffic, because it is a particularly challenging area to take a bus as it is. And so I suspect in the future we may need to consider whether there need to be any yellow lines on the road in certain points. If there's going to be cars parked on both sides of the street, we could find a situation where buses can't get through. So I think we will only know once the units go ahead. But this is one of the situations, this development that we find ourselves in many times around this table, because of the planning scheme as it stands, and that is that if we are to refuse something, we can only do so on the grounds that it does not meet certain criteria against the planning scheme. And whether we like something or not, unfortunately, can't come into it. And whether we think it's acceptable to have 8 units on that piece of land or not, that's everyone's subjective personal opinion, and we're not allowed, as we sit as a planning authority, we're not able to use those opinions. We have to rely on does it meet the planning scheme or not. If we don't do that, we have to be able to cite reasons within the planning scheme which it does not comply with, and that has to stand up in the tribunal. And if we don't do that, then if it goes to an appeal, you know, if the developer in this case or any other case that's come before us, if we just knock something off because we don't like it, or we think that, you know, maybe it doesn't comply when we've been given professional advice against the scheme that it does, then we risk significant sums of money defending that position in the tribunal. And so we do have a duty, as when we sit as a planning authority, to assess this with the advice that the qualified professional advice that we're given of our staff, because of the complexity of the planning scheme, and none of us around this table are qualified planners. And so we do rely on that advice, and the advice that we have received for this development is that it does comply with the planning scheme, and therefore the recommendation is for it to be approved. So I, like Councillor Street, I appreciate that for the representors that were part of this, that will be disappointing, but that unfortunately is the way under which we are bound to operate as a planning authority. Now, who did move it? Councillor Cordova, you moved it. Did you wish to sum up?
Yes, thank you. Briefly, Mayor, thank you to everyone for their contributions, and thank you once again to their representors who made their case so clearly and so passionately. And we've heard tonight that there's a great deal of sympathy for those positions, but the result is... we'll wait and see. But on the point of deferral, it was raised by a representative that, you know, could we defer this? But we've heard clearly about these statutory timeframes, and whether or not a deferral would be possible within statutory timeframes. There's clearly no appetite around this planning authority to do so. And notwithstanding Councillor Street's well-made point that perhaps using the 178 square metres per unit at Frasier Crescent is, yeah, you know, one could argue subjectively that it's a poor mirroring of the characteristics of the surrounding area. The reality is that that is just one single data point out of the others that were raised. Tonic Hill Court, I drove around the area today again, and I've been around there on my e-scooter many, many times, and I spent a lot of time at the sports centre, so I know the area well. The The area, whether it's Summerlees Road or Kingston View Drive, there is a lot of higher density in that area already. So this is not an uncharacteristic development for that area. And critically, all of the planning signals that we're given from the regional land use strategy, the strategic plan of Kingborough itself, we're constantly saying that the best thing for good planning, for good strategic planning, is to have higher density in areas that are close to good infrastructure. Being close to shops, being close to medical, being close to areas that can support that kind of intensification of use, that's where the new higher density should go. And I think we do all reflect on the fact that we're living through a housing crisis. We want to see more good housing go into areas that can sustain more good housing. And so it's critically important that we, as our planning authority, play our role within the constraints that the planning scheme provides us to deliver on that good strategic and statutory planning, and that's what we're doing today. So once again, I'm very sympathetic to the position that's been raised by the representors, but as we've seen from the report and from the discussion throughout this evening's debate, the reality is that this is a good, it's a good step forward for the community as a whole, even though it will have impacts on those seven representors and their households. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. I'm going to put the recommendation moved by Councillor Cordova and seconded by the Deputy Mayor. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? The motion is carried unanimously. This means that the Planning Authority meeting adjourns at 6:55 p.m. and the open session of Council recommences at 6:55 p.m. We're on page 99. Petition still being actioned. A report on the petition curbside collection Leslie Vale will be provided to a future Council meeting. Still on the same page, at the time the agenda was compiled, no petitions had been received. 15.1 Amendment Dog Management Policy Proposed Areas with a recommendation on page 101, and I'm looking for a mover and a seconder, please. Got a mover in Councillor Bain and a seconder in Councillor Fox. Councillor Bain.
Thank you, Mayor. So the purpose of this report is to present the outcomes of the public submissions and consultation regarding the proposed establishment of a dog exercise area at 34 Maddox Road, Kingston, and a dog training area at Drew Point Margates, and to provide recommendations. So Council received 145 engagement survey submissions and 15 written responses, which is great to see, people having their say. And pleasingly, the overall support for the exercise area was 64% and for the training area was 60%. So people seem to be generally pleased. There was a few issues which were raised. So I have a couple of questions leading from those. First one is, when it comes to developing the dog exercise area at 34 Maddox Road, will further engagement occur with the surrounding neighbours?
It's just me.
It's important to note that this is the declaration process under the Dog Control Act. So the development is subject to a development application because there's a change of use. So there will be an advertising process with a further opportunity for people to put in a submission in relation to that process. Yes.
Councillor Bang.
Great. And another thing which was raised was the parking numbers compared with the current Kingston View Drive. Are they reasonably similar in number?
Mr. Smee.
Yes, arguably the parking will be better at Maddox Road. There'll be dedicated parking provided through this proposed development, whereas the one at Kingston View Drive is just on-street parking at the moment.
Councillor Bain.
Thank you. And I think the very pleasing thing to see is, from a usability perspective, everything that's currently offered in the Kingston View Drive site in terms of greyhounds, puppies and other areas is also going to be available with the new site. So I think it's worth congratulating the staff who have found these new sites, and very pleased that the users are going to get exactly the same services, if not better. And just the final question is, this is obviously to do with needing to site up the Sports Centre for the High Performance Centre. So just the final question is, will all costs for these new facilities be met by the State Government?
Mr. Smee.
Yes, that's correct. There has been a budget allocation made as part of that project from the State Government towards the development of these areas.
Councillor Bain.
Fantastic. So I'm happy to support the recommendation.
Thank you. Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Mayor. I dare bring up CCTV again. Just wondering on whether or not we foresee to have some antisocial dog issues at these sites with the increased size of them, and I would assume use, on whether or not that is something that we consider or should be considering.
Increased size of the areas or the dogs?
Numbers of dogs, the size of the, it's an increased size available for the dog community, and there will be an increase in the number of dogs together. What's our view on whether or not these sorts of sites probably should have a or two CCTV?
Mr. Smee.
I have to say that the experience with the existing exercise areas that we have is that they're not a an area in which we experience antisocial behaviour. So on current evidence, I'd say there's no justification for CCTV cameras. Obviously, if that changes in the future, we'd consider it. But certainly given the number of exercise areas we currently have and almost no reports of antisocial behaviour, I mean, obviously, there may be some reports of poor dog behaviour, but not antisocial people behaviour.
Well, that's refreshing, Councillor Entirely.
And if there's reports of poor dog behaviour, what do we normally do? Do we just sort of investigate it on an ad hoc basis, or is that uncommon?
Mr. Smee.
It depends on what the situation is. Obviously, a dog attack is a serious matter that requires investigation, formal investigation, and there are penalties under the Dog Control Act for that. If it's more an issue of low-level conflict between dogs, that might be something that we undertake some public education on.
Councillor Antoli.
Thank you. Yeah, I also noticed that there was feedback in the engagement document about some concerns, I don't know why, or warranted on increase in theft or, you know, I can't remember the exact wording from the engagement policy, but there were concerns about people being concerned that all of these people are now coming to my area, they're going to now come and break into my home or something like that. Mm-hmm. But I didn't know what that was based on, some sort of past experience or just the usual fear and paranoia that we all have sometimes.
I'd suggest if more people are around, your house is probably safer. We can only speculate what that comment was in relation to.
My view is this is a huge win. It's obviously very popular. You know, we're talking about 60-70% support rate, and I'm all for it. Obviously, I'm biased, I'm a dog person, but it's a good win for the community, and the results in the engagement prove it. So thank you for the officers for their work and thinking it through.
Thank you. Thank you, Councillor Antoli, for the conversations. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. Briefly, I will reiterate a little bit of what Councillor Antoli said, that majority popular support for these initiatives, and it's a sign of good engagement. The result itself, it's immaterial, but what's a sign of good engagement is the level of response. 145 responses, that means people heard about it and they got involved, which is really important. As has been raised, this is, I see it as not just a like for like, but there's clear, I think, improvements in the existing situation with the new amenity that's going in. I just wanted to draw everybody's attention to what the responses were in relation to what are the most important features you'd like to see included in the new exercise area at Maddox Road, and that was things like secure fencing, which we'd expected, but also water taps and bowls and waste bins and dog bag dispensers. But it was also things like parking availability, which has been mentioned so far, and then the other things like shaded seating and separate areas for small and large dogs. I think it's an opportunity whenever we get something new, it's an opportunity to improve on what we already had and to reflect on what the community said about it. So I actually think that in a way, were it not for the AFL High Performance Centre, things would have gone on and the status quo would have continued for some time. This is actually an opportunity to interdict and to have new facilities, which I would hope have better amenity, better furniture, better options, hopefully better lighting, better parking, things like that. So it's an opportunity for a refresh and a restart, and I think that's a good thing. So once again, thank you to the staff and to every one of those 145 people who had their say, and I look forward to the next steps. Thanks.
Thank you. Further contributions? I might just make a brief one and then I'll go to you, Councillor Fox. Look, I just wanted to reiterate that I know that when we secured the AFL High Performance Centre, we were concerned that there were going to be a number of community facilities that were going to be impacted, and so as a council we all said that you know, the condition of the state government being able to have the centre there at the Twin Ovals would be that all of the facilities that needed to be moved would be relocated, and that we would find something that was at least as good as what was already there. And I know the staff did work very hard and look at quite a few number of different sites around the Kingston area to replace the facility up at the Twin Ovals, because we know that people really enjoy it. If you look at the figures of the numbers who go there on a daily basis, you know, it is enjoyed by a lot of people. It's a social thing, not only for the dogs but for the people as well, to meet one another. Interestingly enough, I'm led to believe that we have one of the highest numbers of off-lead dog areas in around at least southern Tasmania, because this is, we have 14 off-lead areas at the moment, so they will now become 15 because we're losing one and putting on two, and then we have the two dog obedience training areas, one at Lower Longley and one that will now be at Drew Point. So I think that that's says something about our commitment to ensuring that people who love their dogs have different places that they can go and let them run around and do what dogs love to do. So thank you to the staff who have found this solution, and look forward to seeing this progressed. Councillor Fox.
Yes, I agree with all your sentiments. I guess as a grandmother and a former dog owner, I'm just wondering whether the Maddox Road area maybe in future could provide toilets, because there are no toilets nearby to that area. There are plenty of toilets at Drew Point. There were plenty up near the sports centre. But this location here doesn't provide for, as far as I can tell, for toilets. I'm just wondering if that's been considered.
Mr. Smee.
It's not included within the current proposal. The like-for-like replacement, there are no toilets at the current facility, and we certainly couldn't push the Friendship to argue that the toilets would be part of the package for this one. I guess we would... we would let things settle in before we consider whether there's a need for a toilet facility there in the future. But given these days, you can have a modular unit that's relatively cheap. It's certainly something that can be considered in the future.
Thank you.
Further discussion? If not, Councillor Bain, did you want to sum up?
Thank you, Mayor. Just briefly, I also wanted to thank the Kingborough Dog Walkers Association and the Southern Obedience Club, who helped us arrive at these two locations, and I'm sure also promoted the consultation survey feedback. So it's great when our associations work with us to arrive at results like this. So thank you very much.
Thank you. I'll put the recommendation now. Moved by Councillor Bain and seconded by Councillor Fox. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? Motion is carried unanimously. The CEO is going to leave us now because he has a conflict of interest, as we move into item 15.2, CEO performance review policy, with a recommendation on page 121. And I'm looking for a mover and a seconder, please. And a mover in the Deputy Mayor and a seconder from Councillor Cordova. Deputy Mayor.
Thank you. It is a requirement that we have a performance review policy. We didn't previously have one, so we did engage a consultant. It's a good review. I think it reads well. I can't see any problems with it. I look forward to hearing what others have to say.
Okay, comments. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you. Yes, I think that... so the history of this, as I understand it, maybe I'll frame this as a question, is that we actually embarked on... this is before my time, so I've been on the council now nearly 6 years, or 6 years, I guess, and it was not long before I came on board that I believe it was Councillor Atkinson that recommended the formal review of the general manager, as it was then called. But the way in which we undertake it now, I think, is much more aligned with good governance practice. And I think a critical thing for the community to understand is that the role of the councillors is really to strategically direct the CEO or the general manager in what they do. And so in the discharge of their duties, we're, as councillors, unable to actually direct council staff what to do. It's the responsibility of the CEO whom we govern. So the CEO is the staff member that we have most impact on, and it's therefore the CEO's responsibility to direct the staff in the discharge of their duties. So it's an enormous responsibility, and it's a critically important a field that we make sure that we have repeatable, accessible and transparent mechanisms for saying when we think there has been either a satisfactory outcome or an unsatisfactory outcome from our CEO's performance. So that's why I think the more rigour that we apply to this, the better off we'll be, and that's why this is another step in the right direction of formalising the way that we review our CEO's performance. So for all of those reasons and more, I support the motion.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Councillor Fox.
I do support the motion, but I do have concerns about the fact that the performance review panel is chosen by the councillors, but I feel that they should actually report back to the full council. I appreciate the fact that the review would be done by a subcommittee, but at the end of the day, every council around the table should have a say in the outcome of that review and whether they're, they have things to add or whether they're happy with it or not happy with it. The way this seems to be written is that the onus relies on the subcommittee rather than all council.
So my understanding of this is at 6.6.2, where it talks about the subcommittee's report. So the subcommittee has to make a report that they then provide to the CEO, and then that report comes back to councillors as a whole in closed session. And the point here that it makes is that councillors need to respect the process, and the discussion then is on understanding the report, not providing yet another avenue for feedback, because the process has to, I guess, end at some point. So, yes, it is the intention that the subcommittee would bring back to full closed session of council the report.
But it doesn't say that in this document, does it?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Spinks.
It's also covered off in paragraph 513, which does require a report to come back to council. Yeah. So it's specifically named up there.
Oh, yeah, it is. Following any final discussion with the subcommittee, the mayor will produce a final report for endorsement by the council in a closed meeting. Yeah. And that's, and just to clarify, that is the way that that this has been operating. So the history of this is that up until the recent amendments to the Local Government Act, there was actually nothing written down in the Act that mandated that CEO performance reviews or general managers, as the case may be, needed to take place. It's something that we have been doing here at Kingborough for at least, I'm actually thinking back, so at least, well, the whole time I've been here, and Councillor Fox might know otherwise, but I recall the general manager before last, who was here when I started in 2011, certainly there were performance reviews, surveys. What we haven't ever had, though, and it was something I was very conscious of when I came into the role as mayor, is that there were no written down guidelines on, you know, how should we actually go about doing this. There was just, I guess, a process that had evolved, and it was the discretion of the mayor of the day or the committee as to how those reviews would progress. I'm happy to say that we've always done them very thoroughly in the time here, because I think that a number of us have had experience with boards or at CEO levels where we understand the importance of performance reviews on an annual basis, and then working together to set the KPIs for the organisation and the leader of the organisation for the following year. what has changed, I guess, now is just that it is legislated. It's mandatory for all councils, regardless of their size, for them to go through this process. And what we realised, though, that we didn't have was the written down policy. As I understand, many councils still don't. So I think we're getting ahead and really just making sure that for the future that it's very clear and fair how the process is taken through. Any further comments? Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Mayor. I've had the privilege of being on the review committee this particular season, and I do agree with what you said, that it has been, in my view, handled well. I've been a CEO a few times, and I have suffered under 360 degree reviews, and I've been blessed by them. They can be a bruising process to go through, especially when the questions are all over the shop and there doesn't seem to be a consistency, so you get an onslaught of things to improve on that no one ever asked you to even be in charge of. So I think you've done with your team a good job of narrowing that down for our CEO, because the last thing he needs, in our case he needs is a schmozzle of a 360 review. So and we're in the process of that, and to back up what you said, a final report will come to council soon in closed session on that matter. I think we are doing a good job, and I do believe the process that we are following is fit for purpose and excellent. I don't think, with my AICD training and others, I don't think we would get anything but an A or an A+ if we were audited. So I do commend the policy. I do have a question for consideration. There's no mention around anonymity of responses except when, if ever, we go to the community for feedback. And we've rightly so said feedback from the community can't be anonymous because of the legal implications. But what's the policy, or what should we have in there in terms of whether it is an anonymous process for staff and councillors or not? Should that be silent? Should we be silent on that, or should we speak to it somehow?
I think we should probably, thank you for pointing that out. My view would be that we should incorporate that, because certainly one of the questions that I had when I sent out the 19 surveys to councillors and staff, a few people came back to me and said, is this anonymous? And as you'll be aware from the way that we worked, I was the only one who saw the full surveys. I then collated those for the subcommittee to understand the content of it and the scoring and the comments and so on. So, Mr. Spinks, I don't want to put you on the spot, but is there somewhere that we could work that into the document that we've got in front of us now, please?
Good question, Mayor. I'm just trying to find it where it refers to obtaining...
Probably under guidelines, I think.
Just bear with us while we have a look. Yeah, would it be under, would it be a new paragraph 6.7.3 to say surveys of staff and councillors as part of gathering information for the review are to remain anonymous or kept confidential, something confidential. Kept confidential.
Yeah, I think that can be incorporated.
Yeah. Mrs. Morton, sorry to do that on the run. So if it's acceptable to the mover, the Deputy Mayor, and also to Councillor Cordova as seconder, the amendment would be to add a new 6.7.3 that would read responses to surveys, responses to questionnaires.
Survey responses should be kept confidential.
Yeah, gathered as part of this process should be kept confidential.
It's normally managed by the mayor, isn't it? Which you did a good job of making sure it was.
We didn't even know what people said. We just had group responses. Yeah. We didn't even know as a committee member who said what.
As President, responses are to be kept confidential, not is. Yeah. With that, is that acceptable to mover and seconder? Thank you. Okay, we'll incorporate that into the amendment. Councillor Fox.
Does that mean confidential to council or to the committee? Or from the mayor, I think, or from everyone really, except
for the person who receives them. One person has to receive them, and it's the mayor who receives them, and then they're anonymised after that, because obviously the as part of the report, then that information is used, but it's not specifically referred to that councillor. Yeah.
Do we need to say mayor, or do we just leave it as is?
To be kept confidential, I think. Is that fine as it is? Yep.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Any further discussions? No. Thank you very much. Councillor Gladewright, did you want to sum up? No. Okay. I'll put the recommendation moved by Councillor Gladewright and seconded by Councillor Cordova. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? Motion is carried unanimously. We will retrieve the CEO. So that he can come back. We are on page 129, item 15.3, Parks, Recreation and Natural Areas Bylaw number 3 of 2021, application for a permit, with a recommendation on page 132. Looking for a mover and a seconder. Moved, Councillor Dean. Seconded, Councillor Cordova. Councillor Dean.
Thank you, Mayor. Purpose of this report is to consider a request for an extension of a permit to continue operating from a small business owner who is currently operating a mobile sauna down in Torona by the Torona Beach. Just to be clear, a permit has been required because it's a business and it's operating on public land. So 12 months ago, we gave the approval for a trial to last 12 months. And so what we're considering here is an extension of that trial to 3 years. There are a few minor amendments to hours so that the owner can operate during dark mofo. They're all very sensible. And so I'm really happy to support this. Just a comment. I know last time when this came before us, there were some issues raised by residents in relation to the smoke and the impact on the nearby playground and also on the impact on parking, but I have not had a single person reach out to me, and every time I'm walking along that stretch of the beach, it's busy, it's popular, and there's been lots and lots of positive feedback from the community about this. So I think the trial was a sensible idea to go 12 months. And I think the report is written well, and I'm glad that we've been able to accommodate the request for the slight adjustment to the hours from the applicant. So all in all, happy to support this and see it continue on for the next 3 years. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Dean. Further contributions? Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Mayor. Likewise, happy to support this. I personally hate saunas, hate the whole concept of being stuck with strange people in a box in steam, but that's because I'm weak and feeble. But I love the idea. I have lost count the number of my friends, who are pretty much all couples, go together. I think it's a beautiful bonding experience. Going from the hot and then dipping in the water. I note that there's one down at the Salty Dog, which is very popular. I mean, this is a great thing, and so I'm happy to support it. And I'm grateful that Council's given the operator an extension for 3 years. It's very in right now, Australia-wide. I have two friends on the mainland that manufacture saunas for residential use. They will never get business out of me, but good on them. So, yeah, happy to support it. And it's the scientific evidence for it is pretty strong. But I won't be taking it up myself personally, sorry.
Thank you. Any further discussion? No, I'll ask Councillor Dean if he wants to sum up. Okay, the recommendation moved by Councillor Dean, seconded by Councillor Cordova. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? Motion is carried unanimously. Takes us to page 134, hall fees, with a recommendation on page 136. Looking for a mover and a seconder, please. Moved, Councillor Cordova. Seconded, Councillor Gladewright. You twitched, you're getting it.
Okay, Councillor Cordova. Oh, sorry, Councillor Fox, I didn't see you.
Thank you, Mayor. Really important one. So there was a situation that arose where there was a... we have hall committees, and some of the hall committees were charging slightly different prices, and so there was concern that the hall fees were not similar to those charged elsewhere in other municipalities. And so as a result, there's a review that's been conducted, and the council notes the review of the hall hire fees and advises hall management committees that it considers the current structure to be fair and equitable. I wanted to move this in order to make the point that we are deeply grateful and owe the hall committees an enormous debt of gratitude for their work and their service to the community. As it reflects in the report, it is the costs to the council of maintaining these halls, and the quantum I forget, but it's something around $76,000 per year or something like that. Those costs would be similar whether it was the council managing the bookings and organising those things, or whether it was the volunteer hall committees. But what's critically important is that the hall committees provide a sense of identity and community and service to each other that really deepens the connection that residents have to their area. So I can't emphasise enough how grateful I am to those committees who are giving us a sense of having that village feel even after... I mean, my local hall is the Sandfly Hall. For 100 years, that hall has been servicing the community. And it's largely thanks to volunteers across the municipality that we have those services available. But of course, there's an enormous amount of money and renovations and work that council officers have to do in order to undertake the necessary renovations and upgrades and maintenance of those facilities. So we need to make sure that some of that cost is recovered, and that's why we set the fees accordingly. And so the results of the report speak for themselves, but I did want to take the opportunity to recognise the enormous amount of work that volunteers do, but also take into account the costs that are associated with that that the council has to bear. And therefore, it is important that, as a matter of principle, those who are getting the most benefit out of those community halls do need to contribute, and particularly when there's a commercial underpinning for a particular activity at a community hall, there should be some contribution commensurate with that benefit that that commercial activities are getting from the use of those halls. I look forward to the discussion, and I thank the council officers for their great work on this.
Thank you. Further discussion, Councillor Dean.
Thank you. Just a couple of questions from me. Just going off the high fee comparisons, I haven't gone beyond what's been provided to us, but I note that when you look at our neighbouring councils, they have gone for various categories based on size and type of hall. We've just gone for one, by the, can I just clarify that we have, have we just gone for one blanket fee, regardless if it's Torona or Woodbridge or Sandfly?
Correct.
That's right.
You want to hear it from Mr. Smee?
I want to, and the follow-up would then be...
He doesn't believe me. Mr. Smee.
With the exception of the hub, which obviously has different fees, yes, we have a blanket fee structure across all of our halls.
Heard it from me first, but keep going. Councillor Dean.
My follow-up was just then, could I just have an explanation as to was there thought to following other councils in applying differential rates based on the size or amenity of a hall in terms of the facilities that it has, or an explanation, basically? Thank you.
It's just me.
Yeah, look, we've considered it, and there's not a huge difference between all of our halls. Not enough to warrant a differential fee structure, and generally speaking, the costs of providing each are very similar. So if you take Huon Valley, for example, there's some really big halls and there's some really small ones, but we don't have that level of difference in size and quality. We have halls that are more used than others, but But generally speaking, when you pay your hire fee, you're getting a similar product across the municipal area.
Councillor Dean.
Thank you. Just another question. Was there any consideration to following other councils in terms of kind of going away with volunteer-managed halls, noting Councillor Cordova's point and in the report that we obviously value our management committees and the volunteers that support them? The bit in the report that got me thinking was the argument that a committee doesn't necessarily save any money, but when I think in practical terms of trying to hire my local hall, we don't have to pay for a fob system. I go pick up the key from, well, first I ring up the bowls club, they take my call, then I go pick up the key from someone's house who has to be home. I would have thought that those might be reasons to argue that committees do essentially save us, not necessarily straight up fees, but also staff time for managing them. So how did we navigate that, or how did we communicate this to our hall committees to say, well, look, we value you, but you don't really save us any money, and we're just going to keep it as it is, and you now have to pay all the same or charge the same to your users. So how did that go down in terms of a selling piece or a communication piece with our committees?
It's just me.
I'd certainly echo the sentiments around valuing our hall management committees. I think their true value is in the activation of the halls. I think without hall management committees, we would have considerably less use. And the reality is, in relation to costs, that there are high fixed costs associated with the provision of halls. And yes, the committees would save a small amount of money through things like bookings, although these days with the ability to have online bookings and remote access, that requirement to go and pick up a key is now gone. So, I certainly every opportunity I get when I meet with our hall management committees, I do reiterate the fact that council values them highly, appreciates the work they do for the community, but their true value really is in being connected with the community, providing a facility that the community can engage with, that can be a focal point for the community, and in activating use of the hall. No one does it better than the people that know their community the best. So certainly that's been the message that I've been keen to convey to the committees, that they are valued and they do have that provision to apply to council for a variation on fees if they have a really important community activity or program that warrants a deviation from our fees. That provision is there.
Councillor Dean.
Yeah, I was just going to stress that or ask about that last clause to be able to provide the provision, just to point that out, but also just to, I guess, appreciate from what I'm hearing that there isn't any intention from us as a council to go down the path of other councils to absorb the management of our halls on a blanket basis. So thank you very much for the answers. Thank you, Mayor.
Further questions, Councillor Fox?
I'm just wondering whether there is a policy on the frequency of hiring or booking by individual groups, or whether there's a policy might exist that allows for sharing of the halls and not having a group dominating a hall. I know that there was a concern in Blackmans Bay at one stage where a church group had taken over the hall and there were hardly any bookings left for anybody else, or a play group, for example, taken over the hall and the bookings were made in advance, and whether there is a written policy about trying to make it equitable for everybody to be able to hire a hall. That's one question. I've got another one.
Mr. Snee.
No, we don't have a policy on the level of hiring. In saying that, I can't think of any examples where there is one hirer who is dominating the hiring of any particular hall. We have some historical hirers who have been hiring our halls for over 20 years, but that would only be two nights a week. The only hirer that we have that has a is dominating the hire, should I say, is at the Longley Hall, which has a very low level of community use, community hiring. So that would be the only example where that occurs, and it's currently not putting anyone else out in terms of their ability to hire it.
Councillor Fox.
I mean, 3.5 decades ago, I used to be a basket making teacher, and I probably frequented all the halls around Kingborough. But the worst one was down at Middleton, where I had to drive for 45 minutes to Dover to collect the key to go to Middleton to teach.
Jeez.
And then return it to the person in Dover. And I guess it's important for council to have the key accessible and close to the hall rather than having to drive across the country to get it.
Mr. Smee.
I would agree with that sentiment. And the majority of our hall booking agents live very close to our halls.
Ooh, hall booking agents. That makes them sound very official, doesn't it? Excellent. Any further discussion? The Deputy Mayor.
I've been making a lot of bookings recently for halls in the Huon Valley, and they've got a really great website that they use for their hall bookings called Space2, and I think it's something that should... I can see you nodding. Yeah, you're aware of that one?
It's just me.
I'm aware that we could provide a better service to our community in terms of online bookings and... in particular in relation to our halls, yes.
Yeah, well, I can highly recommend Space2. It's got a really good interface. It's really intuitive, easy to use. It was really easy to pick up the instructions on how to download the app to get in and all those sorts of things. So highly recommend.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Councillor Fox.
I used to drive to Gordon, not to Dover.
Still
from
a good
Middleton
drive.
To Gordon was a fair distance and back. Yeah.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Councillor Cordover, sum up?
I would like to sum up and to thank everybody for their contributions and especially the staff and the volunteers, as I mentioned in my contribution. It will be a point of sensitivity for those people who want to make sure that service provision at the halls remains and that it feels fair and equitable. And that it feels accessible, because we don't want to be putting up unnecessary barriers to the community in order to access these great community pieces of community infrastructure. And I have a mea culpa as well to clear up when I misspoke. That I'm going to quote now directly from 5.1, that in the 2024-25 financial year, Council spent $794,000 on the provision of our 15 community halls, and we received $75,500 in income, noting that hall management committees retain higher fees to cover operational expenses. So those are the actual figures, and I misspoke before, and I apologise for that. It gives us a sense of the financial cost of upkeep, maintaining these buildings and making sure that they have an extended life that goes, you know, as I mentioned, Sandfly Hall has been around for 100 years and I hope to see it around for 100 more, well, indefinitely, really. And these are important community assets that people care deeply about, and whatever we can do to make sure that we manage these in a sustainable way for the benefit of future generations, we must do. And that therefore means that the contributions are necessary. So I was pleased to see that our hall hire fees are commensurate and the current structure is fair and equitable. So I commend the motion. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'll put the recommendation, moved by Councillor Cordover and seconded by the Deputy Mayor. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? The motion is carried unanimously. Takes us to item 15.5, appendices. Looking for a mover and a seconder, please. I've got a mover in Councillor Bain and a seconder in the Deputy Mayor. Just a correction to one of the appendices, the calendar. It did have the
does have the Access Committee as meeting on the second Wednesday of February. It's actually the third Wednesday of February. Just a small change there. But any other questions? Councillor Bain.
Thank you, Mayor. Just noticed that we had a recent visit from Minister Kerry Vincent. Just wondering if there's any exciting news to come from that visit.
So the CEO and myself met with Minister Kerry Vincent at our request, and also we took with us representatives of the Friends of Longley Area Group and the other group whose name has now left my head. Sorry. Leslie Vale Community Association, yep, to talk about the intersection of Leslie Road and the Huon Highway, because that's been of concern to the local residents for some time. And so the representatives of those clubs had the opportunity to put their concerns directly to the Minister, who did say that he would go and have a look at the intersection. He's very hands-on, Minister Vincent, and he said he'd once gone and sat down at the Sandfly intersection and watched how it worked for 45 minutes. So he likes the opportunity to see things, and we did point out some of the issues in relation to speeding through there, the issues with the trucks coming from the quarry, which have been increasing, as well as concerns about the drop-off by the school buses for children who then have to cross the road. So it was a case well put by the representatives of the two organisations, and we've left that with Minister Vincent to consider. And then while we were there, we took the opportunity to also discuss a couple of other infrastructure issues in the area, trying to get an idea of when the duplication of the Algona Road intersection would be carried out. And that's, I haven't got my notes in front of me, but I believe the Minister indicated it was still a couple of years away. The CEO will find that. We also did raise, you may recall, at the last, pretty sure it must have been our last council meeting, that there was a local resident who asked a question about queuing for the Bruny Island Ferry. So I took the opportunity to directly approach that with the Minister, and I'm following that up with a letter, because I understand, even though there were some workers that were employed by the Department of State Growth to try and manage the traffic flow and the queuing better over the lead up to the Australia Day long weekend, it still resulted in massive delays, particularly for people who were not trying to queue for the ferry, but were caught up in it and couldn't overtake. And it's a very dangerous situation. So the Minister did, we suggested a number of things that needed to be looked at, and he's undertaken to do that as well. I think that was about it. But we have a date on Algona Road. CEO.
Yeah, thank you. So the Algona Road duplication is still going through EPBC approval, so that's an environmental analysis done at the federal level to make sure that there's not untoward environmental damage as a result of it. So that creates a bit of an unknown in the process, but it's expected to be tendered late this year for works.
Anything further? Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. My question relates to the 10th of December meeting, the CEO's activities report, with the meeting with Launceston City Council CEO, Mr. Sam Johnson. And my question is relating to the Launceston City Council proposal for a four-day work week for full-time employees employees would continue to receive 100% of their current pay. In 1926, the Ford Motor Company introduced the five-day work week, and then in 1948, Australia introduced or formalised the five-day work week, and we're now in 2026. And so I certainly applaud the Launceston City Council for taking that evidence-based approach to modernise their work week, particularly with the advent of new technology, which enhances people's ability to engage with work. My question is, was that
proposal raised at that meeting, and is that something that we are learning from the City of Launceston, and is there a plan to implement a four-day work week in Kingborough?
The CEO.
Thanks for the question. It was discussed during that meeting. What I would say is I think taking isolated pieces within a EA out of context and only looking at one element can be problematic. It's part of an overall package that's been proposed as part of the bargaining that Launceston is undertaking. In terms of the detail, I can't say that I'm in that detail, and that's something for Launceston to consider. I guess as it relates to here, it's not something that has been the subject of any planning or consideration to this point, but we always watch with interest what other councils and organisations do to see what we can learn.
Any further questions? If not, I will put the motion moved by Councillor Bain, seconded by Councillor Glade-Wright. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? Motion is carried. Takes us to, I haven't turned my page, bear with me, notices of motion. There are no notices of motion. And now we're on page 139, confirmation of items to be dealt with in closed session. In accordance with Regulation 17 of the Local Government Meeting Procedures Regulations 2025, Council by absolute majority moves into closed session to consider the following items: confirmation of minutes and applications for leave of absence. Looking for a mover and a second. I've got a mover in Councillor Fox and a seconder in the Deputy Mayor. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? Motion is carried. So thank you very much to everyone who has been with us this evening, both in person and also those watching along at home on the live stream. In accordance with council meetings and councillor workshops, audio recording guidelines policy, recording of the open session of the meeting will now cease. So open session adjourned at 7:45 p.m. Good evening.